This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.
Hi, everyone. Welcome in to another edition of the Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Bartholomew. Today, a discussion with Casey of the Providence Democratic Socialists of America. All right, hope you're having a spectacular week. We are rapidly approaching Election Day, and B-Town's got you covered with episodes coming up, profiles on candidates. There's already a few that have been posted. Some of the broader discussions that are kind of forming context around this election, and of course, some stuff on the presidential contest. I think I'm going to have to release more than two episodes per week as we get closer to Election Day. So, B-Town, your election headquarters, I think that's Channel 12's, we're taking it. Your election headquarters right here for Rhode Island and beyond. And by the way, there's over 240 episodes of Rhode Island's podcast of record, the Bartholomew Town Podcast, ripodcast.com, wherever you're listening right now, Spotify, Apple, etc. And while you're there, why not leave a rating and a review? It helps grow the program's reach. And if you'd like to support the independent journalism, opinion, analysis, and entertainment that B-Town has become known for here in the Ocean State and beyond, a great way to do so is to head to our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/BartholomewTown. For as little as $3 per month, you can help to sustain this program. And for $10 a month, you may become a B-Town Insider, where you'll receive exclusive monthly content, everything from bonus episodes to commentaries by me on what's going on, discussions about what's been happening on Twitter, maybe some music. patreon.com/BartholomewTown. And hey, for all of you patrons out there that have already done this, I can't thank you enough for helping me basically cover the fundamentals of this show. You know, the hosting fees, the fees for Zoom so I can conduct these interviews remotely in HD, some of the live streaming stuff that we do. It's sincerely appreciated, and it's really helping to cover the baseline of this operation. So thanks. And by the way, you can email me anytime, bill@ripodcast.com. Follow me on Twitter at Bill Bartholomew. Over on Instagram, we've got at Bartholomew Town Podcast. I'm also there, the human being account, I guess, at Bill Bartholomew. And you can join the Bartholomew Town Podcast Facebook group for live stream content. We've been out at most of the actions that have taken place throughout this calendar year. I'm at the governor's press conference every Wednesday. I've been there for well over 100 of those, asking questions. Other live stream stuff as well, btown.stream. Okay, that was an enormously long and potentially annoying and damaging promo, so let's get right to the episode, all right? Casey, the Providence Democratic Socialist of America, right here on B-Town. I guess let's start with sort of an overview of, for the listeners out there, that, you know, just sort of an explainer, 101 explainer on what the DSA is, what work you've done in Rhode Island in general, and kind of where, what your role is with all of that.
Yeah, so so the DSA in Providence, we have the local chapter here, and we have a lot that we're working on right now. We have a labor group. We have the Defund the Police group that formed in June, that the No Cop Money Project lives out of. We have the Nationalize the Grid Committee, which has been kind of a cornerstone of the chapter. We have a really active reading group that meets on Sundays, and we also have a political education committee that is working on internal political education as well as some external events we're going to do as well. I'm a member of the executive committee. I'm the chapter secretary, and I'm also kind of a new member. I joined in January to work on the Bernie campaign and do some canvassing for Bernie Sanders. And then I was elected to the executive committee in March.
I think I've been thinking for a while now, especially here in Rhode Island, but a lot of politics are less left and right in almost a circle where it's sort of like you're either on the outside or on the inside of decision making or power, so on and so forth. I feel like a lot of people use, whether they're talking about socialist ideals, progressive ideals, anything independent, they try to peg that as hyper radical. But a lot of the ideas that you present are really community-based initiatives that you can take away the politics and the, you know, the identity of, or the political ideological identities, take that all away and just present them without any attachment to anything else. And I think many, if not most people, would agree that the issues you raise are super important for the everyday person in Rhode Island or beyond. So we'll get into the no cop money in just a second, but let's talk about nationalize the grid. And, you know, I think back to the Newport gas crisis a few years ago, which still the city is digging out of in many ways, just in general, utilities. And where do you see an example like that fitting into the lives of the average, quote unquote, because that's a, who knows what that really means, but the average listener right now?
I think, you know, what's going on with COVID is kind of a good place to start too. So, you know, people are getting evicted. You know, people are expected to pay, you know, their utility bills, et cetera. They're losing their jobs. And, you know, so something we're looking at right now in the, with the National Alliance of Grid Committee, which actually just got back off the ground recently, so we're kind of newly organizing around that again, is, you know, making sure that the moratorium on utility shutoffs stays, because from our research, it seems like after the 30th, that might change. So we're really looking to continue that moratorium and then, you know, make sure that public utilities are in, you know, in the hands of the people, right? So it's, you shouldn't go through what we're going through right now, or, you know, even outside of COVID, and worry that you can't pay your utility bills, that your electricity is going to get shut off, that you're not going to have heat through the cold winter months.
Yeah, basic fundamental, you know, needs of any human being. And with the world that we've built, with the massive economies that we've built around the world, there are things that should be able to be handled, or every person should be able to have access to, and the economies, quote unquote, should be able to handle that. You know, there's plenty of resources. So it's not particularly radical to say that everybody who is alive should be able to stay warm in the winter.
I totally agree. And that's like really the basis of what democratic socialists believe, is that the economy and society should be run democratically to meet the needs of the people and not just make profits for a few, right? Like not just make profits for the executives at National Grid. You know, it's nuts to me that shelter or, you know, warmth is a profit-making machine.
Let's talk about, just real quick here, Rhode Island politics has really, since the 1930s, has been controlled by the Democratic Party, but that party has gradually, and then it's sometimes full speed ahead, drifted further to the right than even, I don't know, like a Joe Biden or whatever, a quote-unquote moderate Democrat in the national sense of things. So we see this progressive wave that, yes, there have been progressive characters inside the General Assembly like Sam Bell. You could argue folks like Senator Dawn Oyer kind of are somewhere in the middle of having progressive ideologies, but then sort of fall in line with leadership at times. But now we have this new wave with Tara Mack and Cynthia Mendez, others who are entering the General Assembly. Where do you stand and your organization stand in terms of pushing for your beliefs and your goals through the General Assembly? Do you feel like the institutions of power here in Rhode Island can be responsive to what you're calling for?
Well, you know, we had some big wins on the 8th with Sam Bell. Sam Bell's a DSA endorsed candidate, you know, now reelected, and David Morales as well, who was recently elected on the 8th. A DSA endorsed candidate. So, you know, we feel really good about those wins and the work, you know, that we're going to try and push through with the budget alongside like Reclaim Rhode Island and the No Austerity And I think, you know, just looking ahead, who else can we work with that, you know, is a socialist or shares our values that that we can maybe endorse in the future or put forth our own candidates? I mean, I think those are things that we're going to consider and the electoral committee will talk about, which I personally am not super involved with, so I can't speak too much to that. But we saw an incredible wave of progressive wins, DSA endorsed or not. And I think that that shows that the people of Rhode Island are tired of the power structure that currently exists here. You know, there's plenty of quote unquote Democrats that really don't have democratic values or aren't acting that way. And, you know, I think the win of David Morales is a perfect example of that, going up against incumbent Daniel McKiernan and being, you know, a young progressive in that race. His district deserves statehood, right? Like, that's what the people in that district want. So,
yeah, it was interesting on election day seeing McKiernan trying to put up more and more signs throughout the day as I was going around, you know, gigantic signs on magnets, putting them up on fences, and sort of that scramble, just the eyeball test, realizing, hey, look, people are turning out looking for change. One thing that I've called for in the past is in challenging institutions is sort of the suspension of specific ideological or positions on even major issues that are like fundamental issues, and sometimes aligning with Republicans here in the state of Rhode Island, you know, who are now pushing for example, minority candidates to be considered for the vacant Supreme Court position. So there's these opportunities for seemingly weird, I guess, coalitions to be formed. Is that something that you and your group are open to, sort of finding allies that maybe disagree on 90% of your worldview, but then you share a worldview of, hey, we need to challenge the power structure in Rhode Island more than anything else?
Yeah, I think that, I don't know if I could really answer that question because, you know, we're a big tent organization and we don't always agree, right? Like, you know, if I personally were to answer that question, like me as like KC, not as DSA, I wouldn't really want to form those bonds with Republicans, or even some Democrats. But, you know, I think that would be kind of up to the electoral committee in our group and, would take a lot of conversations, but, you know, I don't know the answer to that question. I think that it would have to be discussed for sure.
I guess the best example of that comes in District 15, where you have Barbara Ann Fenton Fung taking on Nick Mattiello, and you wonder, okay, if the coalition got behind Fenton Fung, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of disagreement there, but then you possibly remove Mattiello from office. So it's these weird sort of bonds that can be established, I guess. Yeah. All right, let's get into this massive data project that you've put together, No Cop Money, which is a form in which candidates or electeds, really, who it explains what electeds have taken money from law enforcement or corrections organizations and how much. And what's interesting is in some cases, you've put forth elected officials that are really openly whether it's defund the police or severe structural changes, they call for those things. But then yet based on your research, you prove that many of these same folks have taken money from police organizations. So it presents some confusion, some hypocrisy potentially. So let's talk about the project and what inspired you to begin that and where you'd like to see it go.
Yeah. So this project was put together by a few of us in June in response to the massive calls to defund the police. And, you know, I was just really interested in what politicians and elected officials and lawmakers in our state, you know, who was taking money from police and how much. And it was a massive undertaking for sure. The first iteration of it contained data from people who like had run, but maybe weren't elected. There was people who were no longer in office. So it was a really big, big Google sheet that was very difficult to use. And a few weeks ago, we revamped it. So if you go to nocopmoneyri.org, you can see the new website there. And it's very easy to use. You can put in your zip code. It will bring up all of your representatives, their contact information, their Twitter account, how much money they took specifically from police PACs and also from correctional officers. And there's a call script and email script as well. So that was one big part of it, was creating the civic engagement there around like a really easy ask and a way to connect people with their reps to start having those conversations. We've had four people on that list give back the money that they took and commit to not taking more in the future. So the first one was Aaron Redenberg, and he had taken $500, which, you know, was like a big surprise. But he was also the first to give it back. He gave it to Amore, which is a local organization here in Providence. And then we had Gail Golden gave $225 to the Rhode Island Solidarity Fund. Bridget Valverde gave $275 to the Rhode Island Justice Center. And then Sabina Matos gave the $1,300 to the Providence Student Union, Young Voices and Youth in Action. So she split it up between those three groups. I think what's important to note, though, especially like in Sabina Matos's case, we don't, you know, she gave that money back, but she's not then in turn calling to defund the police, right? So that's an important thing to note, is that we don't really think that this work is going to move the needle on policy or legislation necessarily, but it's a really good way to get that money back to local orgs and to the community who are doing a lot of anti-racist work and are working on calls to defund the police. And then also, like, this work isn't going to by itself bring about legislative change. Like, you know, it's not going to repeal the Law Enforcement Bill of Rights or demilitarizing police departments, but it does kind of hold these elected officials to the fire in a way, and like really ask them to like just totally disassociate from cop money.
Discover over 200 episodes of Rhode Island's podcast of record, the Bartholomew Town Podcast, on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your pods. Or head over to our website, ripodcast.com. Here in Providence, and, you know, it's difficult to say without a proper data analysis, but there has been at least some increase in violent crime in this month here in September. At least in terms of awareness. I know in Elmwood, we've had some stuff that's gone unreported as well for various reasons that I've just seen with my own eyes. But we've seen on a statewide perspective this notion that, hey, Providence is dangerous. I've seen media members saying, hey, don't go to Providence. You can't go there. The mall is, you know, someone's going to jump out from behind a, you know, trash can and mug you if you go into the mall, whatever it is. From a messaging standpoint alone, how do you think it can be squared, the defund the police movement, demilitarize the police movement, any sort of police reforms, with this messaging that's also coming out concurrently that the city of Providence is facing an uptick in crime, or at least a continuation of severe crime? Is it about pointing to the root causes of all of each of those situations, whether it's crime increasing because of increase in desperation, destitution as a result of the pandemic, or systemic inequities? How do you square that?
I mean, I guess the first thing I would say is if there is like a legitimate increase in crime happening right now, I don't think the the appropriate response is like policing immediately. And, you know, I know that there was events that happened at the mall yesterday. And, you know, I worked at the mall at one point, and
worked there,
when a woman had stolen a purse from Nordstrom, and cops chased her out of the building, and she jumped over the garage and like died. So, you know, first, right? Like, I don't think like the response of like adding more police or like continuing to funnel money into policing is the answer to whatever is going on. You know, we have to direct those funds away from, you know, from the militarization of our police, from, you know, like having no more lethal munitions, like turning traffic enforcement over to unarmed civilians. I don't think giving them more money is going to fix that. Like, we need, you know, we need housing, we need a living wage, we need shelter. Like, those are the things that we can work towards. But it's a tough question. Like, I don't have all of the answers, but I am confident that the answer is not giving police more power.
Last couple of minutes here. What would you like to see from a fundamental shift when the General Assembly resumes in January? Let's suppose they resume. And just in general, over the next year, what are key points that you'd like to see happen that can, for lack of a better term, realistically happen here in Providence and on a statewide basis, whether it's policy or messaging or actual institutional changes? What would you like to see?
I mean, right now, the big thing is the budget. The fact that Gina Raimondo is considering, you know, making cuts to these services that are so needed. I mean, needed outside of COVID, but so needed, you know, even more so now, that would even be a consideration is, you know, that's the big work to be done right now. And, you know, I think Reclaim Rhode Island is really leading the front on that. And DSA is working with them as well. But that's the first thing, is like demanding like the no austerity. You know, I personally would like to see a lot more work done around affordable housing. You know, we have a lot of development projects going up right now in terms of luxury condos. We just saw the housing prices like skyrocket. And it doesn't match the scenario of what's going on, right? Like, Rhode Islanders are really struggling, and you know, we need affordable housing, and we need public housing, and we need to stop building luxury condos, thinking that the tax incentives or the money that these like wealthy condo dwellers are going to bring into the communities is going to somehow trickle down, right? Like, that's not going to happen. So the CARES Act money needs to be distributed. Like, we need to help local businesses. We need to help the people living in our communities. So I think the budget is a really good place to start. And I'm really glad that we have Sam Bell in there and other, you know, progressive lawmakers making that call too.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. That's really where... You know, you look at the housing situation here in Providence, or even on a statewide basis, and it's like a sick comedy, you know what I mean, in a lot of ways, where you look at the designs or even some of the plans and even some of the existing infrastructure and compare that to the reality on the ground. It's like basically delusional. And, you know, I've seen this happened in Brooklyn. I've seen this happen in Newport, and I'm now seeing it happen in Providence, where not only does it put so many people at a tremendous disadvantage and potentially puts people on the streets or leaves them outside of the you know, off the cliff, so to speak, of where they can't afford housing. But it also has the potential to wreck whatever culture and vibe is left in the city. And that's what I'm concerned about here as well, is for the residents of the city in all of the different neighborhoods who have plenty to celebrate on across a variety of cultures. Now, all of a sudden, you know, you just sort of give it this generic whitewash of, I don't know, like just the place just looks like a Whole Foods all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, it really uproots like the culture in our neighborhoods. That's, you know, generations of families that have lived there that have really made it what it is. And this, you know, continuing cycle of like disinvestment and then investment when it suits, you know, developers, when it suits politicians, it's traumatic. Like it ruins communities, and we end up seeing, you know, people on the street or people having to move further from their job and move further from their resources, from their social safety nets. And like coupled with the fact that we don't have like great public transit in this city or state, you know, and at the same time we're working, you know, RIDOT is, you know, trying to break up the bus hub in Kennedy Plaza, right? Like that.
Yeah, come on.
Like, it's just, I don't know who they're trying to attract to this city, thinking that like that's the right thing to do when all of the research, you know, states that like these people that they're trying to attract, like these young millennial, you know, middle-class kind of people from Boston, for example, like they want to live in cities that have good public, they want to live in cities that are diverse and in neighborhoods that have like, you know, different income levels and different housing situations. Like that is what the data says.
Yeah.
It doesn't say build these big luxury condos that aren't even going to hit capacity. Right. So,
right.
So it's just mind numbing to me. There's such a better way to do it.
This is the Bartholomew Town Podcast.